Hello, my friends. Welcome back. Dr. Ken Berry here. I've got a great guest. We're going to talk today about the following. Have you ever noticed just how unhealthy school lunches are? What about the lunch and the breakfast and the dinner for hospital patients, nursing home patients? What about our military service men and women, the food that they're forced to eat? Have you ever noticed just how unhealthy it is? Why is that? My guest today, I'm honored to chat with Nina Teicholz, the author of Big Fat Surprise. She led the Nutrition Coalition for a few years, and now she is onward and upward to bigger things. Nina, welcome.
Hi, Ken. Great to see you.
Absolutely. Good to chat with you again. So we're live in our private group, and this will be posted later on YouTube. But only members of the private group will be able to ask you questions today. I've got your slides uploaded that you sent me. And so, first of all, tell everybody a little bit about you, how you came to being a fighter in this fight, and then we'll get started.
Okay. Well, I think people who know me know that I wrote a book called The Big Fat Surprise that came out in 2014. And after that came out, in 2015, our nation's nutrition policy, which actually I wasn't so aware of when I was writing, it's called the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. That was coming out, a version of, it comes out every 5 years. So it was coming out in 2015. I read the nearly 300-page expert report that goes into that to make the guidelines. And I just, it was just an astonishing exercise where I thought, look, for one, it was like one of the worst pieces of science I think I had ever read. And I've read a lot of bad science. As you know, I've read, you know, probably 10,000 scientific papers doing just a research for my book. But also, I couldn't find any of the NIH-funded clinical trials that I knew existed. So all of these, you know, rigorous bodies of science that have been funded by our government, that they just, like, it was as if they didn't exist. They weren't in the evidence base. And I went back through time and realized, wow, they've never been reviewed. We have these guidelines that don't reflect the scientific evidence at all. So I founded the Nutrition Coalition, which is this nonprofit group. And the goal, naively, was to try to fix the dietary guidelines. We could just go to them with the science and say, oh, you forgot this science. And so we wanted, you know, the whole aim of the group was to be diet kind of neutral, but just to say we want guidelines based on a rigorous progress and rigorous science. So that became now, you know, a sort of an odyssey. It's really hard to turn the Titanic. But it's but we have made a lot of progress in a number of ways, which I'm happy to talk about.
Absolutely. And most people realize, just most common people realize, that for many children from poor households, the only nutrition that they get effectively is the food that they're fed in school. And indeed, many of the school programs now offer free lunch, even on the weekends, free breakfast, free snacks in between. And so that sounds outwardly like a good thing. Obviously, it's better to eat than to not eat. But when you look at the actual nutrition that the children are fed, these are growing children with growing brains and nervous systems. They need to be getting plenty of protein, plenty of fat. They need to be getting all of the vitamins and minerals needed to grow that healthy brain. But in many cases, all they're getting is carbohydrates. And I want you to explain to us, how is that possible? I mean, the science of nutrition has known for decades, the National Institutes of Health, they know exactly what you have to feed a child for them to grow up tall and beautiful and healthy and have the highest IQ possible. So why would we not feed that exact food to the growing children in school? What happened here?
Well, that's a great question, because why aren't we acting on the science that we know? It's kind of more like we're going backwards. I think the big picture answer is not so simple, but one of the big picture answers is that when the dietary guidelines were launched in 1980, they were based on a set of incorrect premises. You know, our nation really was healthier and had very low obesity rates and almost no diabetes until, say, the mid-1960s, we started to see slight increases. But we didn't have any guidelines about how to eat, really, until first the American Heart Association came along and said, stay away from saturated fat, and then said, stay away from cholesterol. And then they said, this is all starting in 1961. And then they started saying, well, actually, stay away from fat altogether because there's more calories per gram in fat. It's more dense in terms of its, in terms of calories than the other two macronutrients, protein and carbohydrate. And that whole American Heart Association platform about diet was basically adopted by our government. In 1980, it became our national policy, which is the Dietary Guidelines for Americans. That whole platform, reduce saturated fat, reduce dietary cholesterol, cut back on fat altogether. And if you analyze the diet that the government recommends, it's 51 to 56% of it is carbohydrate. Initially, they were recommending just like 10 to 12 slices of bread per day. Now then it became a little bit more diversified. And then actually they realized that was too much bread, you know, that big bottom slab of the food pyramid. So they cut back, but they still recommend 6 servings of grains per day, including 3 servings of refined grains, and up to 10% of your calories is sugar. And that's the formula, right? And 5.5 teaspoons of soybean oil every day. And then if you're going to eat, you know, the protein category has sort of been diminished over the years. Now it includes peas, lentils, nuts, and all of those are not full complete proteins. I'm sure your audience knows this, you know, compared to meat and dairy and eggs. But if you are going to eat meat, it has to be lean meat because of the saturated fat, and the dairy has to be low fat dairy. So this is a formula pretty much for ill health. It certainly does not bring about good health. It's not what you would call the ancestral diet, the natural human diet. That is not what we were designed to eat. And it's even worse in schools, because while they generally follow the guidelines, like no butter, only soups, you know, only vegetable oil, tons of grains, but there's no cap on sugar. So you have some percentage, like 89% of school meals exceed even the already high 10% of calories on limit on sugar. I mean, that's why we see, I mean, we have just sold out our kids. I mean, they are trying to survive on things like Lucky Charm bars. It literally is a USDA approved food item. And you know, nachos, Doritos, Tostados, Fritos. I mean, just real junk food is what we're feeding our kid. And so part of their explanation, we've been on this bad diet for decades and it's hard to change. The other part of the explanation is the food industry, especially, you know, these packaged processed foods, ultra processed foods, multinational food companies, General Mills, Post, PepsiCo. I mean, they have been lobbying the government forever to get the diet that works for their, you know, those are their products. Those are some products that you're seeing now from the General Mills school site. These are USDA approved products that get fed to kids in schools. So the food industry has really, it's ironic because the USDA is supposed to protect, its mission is to protect our nation's farmers and ranchers, the people who grow and produce the food. But we are in fact protecting the ultra processed and protecting and promoting the ultra processed food industry. Ken, I can't hear you.
Yo, it's interesting how times have changed, because back in the 1910s, 20s, and 30s, the main concern for the federal government was that U.S. citizens get enough nutrition. Many people were malnourished and underfed back then. And so initially, they were trying to promote starchy foods and you know, you've got to how to can your food, how to preserve your food, because there was food scarcity back then. That was a real thing in the United States. But then with the advent of refrigeration and then refrigerated transportation and the processing, that went away. We now have, none of us have any problem. I mean, you can trip and fall on a Cheerio bar. You know, they're just out there randomly. But the federal government, like you said earlier, it's hard to turn around a huge ship in the middle of the ocean. And the federal government still seems to be promoting a starvation diet. Like, yes, if my children were starving, I would give them the peach Cheerio bar and the soft baked cookies. I would give them that to keep them from starving to death. But no one in America is in danger of starving to death. Now, people go hungry, no doubt, but that's different. So it's like they still have not shed the skin of a nation that was malnourished and underfed. And so they're still wanting to promote these things. And I definitely know that there's corporate interest involved, and we'll talk about that later. But just to look at these foods, these things are devoid of nutrition. In no way is this a nutrient-dense food that you would think you would want to feed a child so that they could pay attention in school and so that they could actually progress and develop into a healthy, happy, normal adult.
Yeah, I mean, here, let me tell you something that is so ironic, which is that it's actually refined grains that are enriched and fortified with artificial nutrients like iron and B vitamins. And so that is why I believe the USDA recommends still 3 servings of refined grains a day, because they need those nutrients. Even though people do not absorb supplemented micronutrients as in that way as well as they do when they get it from real food, but without those refined enriched grains, we wouldn't be coming close to our food. And as it is, the dietary guidelines does not meet goals for nutritional adequacy on a number of essential, crucial micronutrients. That means if you're eating these guidelines perfectly, you're still not getting what you need to in terms of nutrients like potassium, magnesium, just to support basic human life. So
it's such a travesty that people have to be basic. I mean, so, and if you're a child from a poor family, and the only real nutrition that you get is from your school breakfast and lunch and snacks, and this is what you're offered, I mean, you are destined for obesity. You're destined for pediatric fatty liver. You're destined for hypertension, type 2 diabetes. Like literally these foods, if I were to sit down and try to defy, to create a food, Nina, it's like, I want this food to be the perfect food to cause type 2 diabetes and fatty liver and hypertension and obesity. This is exactly what I would design. So what did the corporations do? How did they maneuver to so that this is literally accepted by the federal government as acceptable to feed to young innocent children who have no other choice?
Well, I mean, I think all of us, none of us is so naive not to understand that every single one of these food companies has a legion, an army of lobbyists in Washington, and they'll have, you know, at least one person, one lobbyist that just focuses on USDA, right? So getting your products into USDA, defending your grain allotment and recommendation at USDA and not letting that change. It's so interesting because the narrative that you read out in the press that was largely created by NYU nutrition professor Marion Nessel and then perpetuated by a great writer, Michael Pollan, but he kind of kept this myth going, is that it's like the big bad meat industry that has been the negative force in creating dietary guidelines. Like, it's been the meat industry. The reason our guidelines aren't working is the meat industry is just the worst lobby. And the meat industry is definitely a big industry. However, when you look at the evolution of the guidelines, who has won and who has lost? That's how you know if lobbying has been successful, right? Everybody's lobbying, but who's won? Not the meat industry. right? They went from being the red meat is barely even recommended because it's really lean meat, which is chicken and turkey. And we've seen like a 128% rise in the amount of poultry that we eat since 1970, compared to a 35% drop in the amount of beef and 28% drop in red meat overall. So it's not red meat. In red meat, the whole protein category, as I've mentioned, has gotten shrunken. So meat represents less and less of the protein category. And in 2015, they tried in a little footnote to say that they would like to recommend reducing red and processed meat. That was just a footnote. They tried to kind of wedge in there, and then they tried to rationalize a bunch of recommendations based on sustainability arguments, and all of that was taken out. But the meat industry is the loser here. Who's winning? You know, who's winning? Our soybean oil has done very well. Actually, they recently recommended increasing the amount of soybean oil that we consume daily. So since 1970, there's been 89% increase in sale, probably even more now, because when I say to today, that means like 2017 or so. So huge increase in soybean oil. And of course, what you're seeing also in these school products is they are going in and lobbying for the actual contracts in the schools, right? So they're saying, you know, we want our Lucky Charms bowl. We want that on the school, in the school meal approved program. You know who else has, I think, gotten approved by the school meal program is the couple of the fake meat companies. You know, if you can't win in the marketplace, then you mandate it through school lunches by lobbying your federal agency. So, you know, I mean, these are large public, or they have, you know, shareholder value, or they're publicly traded companies, and their fiduciary responsibility is to their shareholders, and that is to then sell more of their products. It's their goal and aim is not to make America healthier.
And I think most people understand that about in a corporate structure, your duty is to the board members and the shareholders. But what about the USDA? Are they just completely ignorant of human nutrition needs, or are they just literally evil enough that all they want is for the lobbyists to take them to the best steak restaurant in DC? What's going on in the mind of the USDA people who are approving this, the very crap that's on the screen right here, right now?
You know, I can only give you some data points that are suggestive, right? I can't tell you what's going on in the mind of people at USDA, but I will tell you. So the expert committee for the dietary guidelines, our group, the Nutrition Coalition, brought about the first ever systematic review of the conflicts of interest on that group, which is appointed for every iteration of the guidelines. A new group is appointed in 2000. For the 2020 guidelines, 95% of those committee members had at least one tie to a food or pharmaceutical company, and more than half of the group had 30 such ties. One of the people on the committee had 151 ties to companies like Nestle and all the major food companies. So, I mean, that's one influence. We also found out that the Office of the Dietary Guidelines itself has almost 100 food industry partners, as they call that. So they work with them and meet with them and figure out ways of working with industry. That seems very cozy and inappropriate to me. And we know that, for instance, the head of the American Soybean Association was the undersecretary of USDA under Trump and came right out of the Soybean Association and went directly back to it right after leaving USDA. So there's a lot of a revolving door that goes on there. So, and I think the other factor is if you look at the office itself at USDA that's in charge of the guidelines, it's staffed by about 30 women. It's all women for some reason, and many of them who have been there for 25 years or more. So this is their policy. You know, they have an intellectual, you know, I don't know if they're going out to steak dinners, but they have a strong intellectual fealty to this particular policy. They seem unlikely to want to change and somehow undermine or discredit their life's work.
And you said that the people at the USDA who make this final decision have ties to the big food industry. Tell us what exactly, when you say ties, and one had over 130 ties, what do you mean by that exactly?
Well, it could be any number of things from our paper, which I don't have right in front of me, but so it could be that they got research funding, they'd be a personal grant, it could be that they got speaker fees, they could have be a consultant, they, in some cases, they were employed by, one was employed as the head of Merck, global some division of Merck. So it's just any connection to to one of these companies.
That's, and so they literally are effectively on the payroll of the big food corporations, and yet they are tasked with deciding what gets approved by the USDA for school breakfast and school lunch.
Well, you know, right. They're part of this. It's partly USDA, that office of those 30 women. And then it's partly this expert committee. The expert committee is supposed to have the final say. But I mean, here's like another shocking thing that happened for the dietary guidelines. They didn't, for the last go around of them, they didn't review any of the studies on weight loss. They decided to ignore all the studies on weight loss. And they've never actually looked at any studies on diabetes reversal or heart disease reversal, because technically they only deal with prevention. So that's only the part of our population that has not yet been diagnosed with some diet-related disease. So the CDC puts the portion of people who have at least one diet-related disease, chronic disease, at 60% of the population. But the number that came out, I believe it was just last year, was 93% of our population either has obesity, heart disease, is on medication for a diet-related disease, or I can't remember what the last criteria is, but basically like 93% of us are in poor cardiometabolic health. That's astonishing. And that means the guidelines are for 7% of us. Right. So, yep. And they don't even look at the studies for us, you know, for the 93% of us that are not well, they don't even look at that scientific literature.
And so never did it occur to them that perhaps a diet that would reverse type 2 diabetes might also prevent it as well. They just didn't make that gigantic, actually tiny mental leap. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a disease does not exist along a continuum. Once you are tip over into the disease state, then you're the purview of the professional societies, the American Diabetes Association, the American Heart Association. It's like a turf issue. Then it's their problem. But you know, if you're 6.4 in your hemoglobin A1C is 6.4, you're not yet diabetic, then you get to be covered by the dietary guidelines. But I mean, here's the tragedy of it, is that the food going out to nursing homes and schools and followed in hospitals, I mean, especially, you know, schools and hospitals, I mean, those are populations with lots of sick people in them, and they're getting a diet designed for healthy people, and not even really designed for healthy people, but technically they have not even looked at the literature for people with any of these diseases. And yet those people are getting this food. I mean, as anybody who's gone to a hospital or seen a hospital photo knows, I mean, those are, you know, those meals are really unhealthy.
And untasty. Absolutely. Now, what is this passion to please, Nina? Explain this to us.
That's the PepsiCo's K-12. So their school program, which they call Passion to Please. And I think I sent you some other pictures of some of their super special offerings. Yeah. So those are all PepsiCo products that are approved to use in schools.
So these are all very nutrient dense, full of vitamins and minerals, full of amino acids and fatty acids. Of course, I'm being sarcastic. These are literal cookies and potato chips. And you're telling us that these are approved by the USDA for school lunch and snack and breakfast.
They are.
Wow. Is anybody else's blood pressure rising right now? Grandma's cookies is a USDA approved food to feed the developing mind of our young children at school.
So the Nutrition Coalition, we just finished up a campaign to try to get you know, there's actually an effort at USDA to reduce the amount of sugar in schools, because as I mentioned, there is no cap on sugar in schools currently, in school lunches currently, and they do have a plan to reduce sugar down to just 10%, but they are starting that in 2027. Not enough data to start reducing sugar in school meals. So we have to wait another 5 years.
Yeah. So the kids between now and then they're just screwed. So there's no hope. And these are more PepsiCo products that are right now, as we speak, approved to feed the children. Oh, Funyuns. That is the penultimate nutrient dense food right there. I freaking loved those as a kid, but I'm pretty sure they didn't help my metabolic health or my brain function.
Well, you know, the tragic thing, as anybody, like probably a lot of people in your audience understand all too well, is that it is much easier to try to stay healthy and just eat well from the get-go. I mean, none of us, you know, most of us are not those people, but just to start with good health and then to maintain your metabolic flexibility, becoming obese, having obesity or diabetes or any disease, and then trying to reverse it, you know, you basically tipped over into an unhealthy metabolic state at that point. It's a lot harder to reverse disease, and you may never be truly metabolically healthy again. So it's just so much easier to prevent these diseases, and yet we are, you know, setting our kids up for a lifetime of health failure.
And as Penny points out, you know, then the teachers get blamed or the parents get blamed because of the behavior or the learning difficulty that the children are having, but we're literally feeding them cookies and potato chips, and then we're expecting them to sit still and behave and learn and keep up with all the other kids. It's unbelievable that this is happening right now in the United States.
Well, and so again, just to go back to the Nutrition Coalition, we are going to launch a kind of a set of materials that parents can use to go into their local schools to advocate for better food. And so if you want to be part of that, just go to our website, which I think is in the show notes, and sign up for our newsletter. And, you know, we'll be sending out information about that. I mean, just to try to get the food a little healthier in schools. I mean, I don't know if any of you have seen pictures of what they serve kids in other countries. It's like, to me, it's like we're, you know, dining out at a fine restaurant compared to what we are giving kids. I don't know how kids can really succeed and concentrate and learn and then grow into healthy human beings. You know, and then it's not too long before they're getting prescribed Adderall or antidepressants, or, you know, I mean, that's just the beginning of a bunch of medications they're going to have to go on.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. So now you included this slide as well, but I'm sure you didn't mean to, because there's no way that the USDA said that pizza is of the caliber of Domino's is okay to feed children at lunch.
Yeah, if you see that NSLP compliant, it means National School Lunch Program compliant. And that means that it probably has a whole grain crust and is lower in sodium than a regular pizza. But otherwise, and that's why it's smart. But otherwise, that's a pizza slice.
Yeah, and I'm sure this pizza is full of grains. And they say whole grain, but you can't make a pizza crust out of true whole grains. Nobody would eat it. This is highly processed grains. I'm sure that the cheese on top of this pizza is mainly soybean oil or canola oil. And then I guarantee you there's as much sugar as they could get in the crust while still being being within the NSLP guidelines for sugar. This is ridiculous. Any other pizza companies get in, or did Domino's have the best lobby?
That I don't know. I just happened to stumble on this one. It just astonished me.
NSLP compliant. Yeah. I think that if you served a dog turd, Nina, and it was low enough in sodium and saturated fat, and you added some vegetable oil to it, that would probably be NSLP compliant, wouldn't it?
Yeah. I mean, that's just a good point about the sodium thing. the trying to reduce sodium for kids, all right, you know, that data is very, very contested in adults, right? There's
Absolutely.
It looks like from the most of the research that's out there that there's a kind of a J-shaped curve and there's an ideal amount of sodium that is kind of intermediary, but to go too low has adverse cardiovascular effects. In children, how much data is there on children and sodium? This much. There's no data. There's no data to show that lowering sodium in kids' meals will prevent cardiovascular disease later in life. And what does it do? It makes the food tasteless. So you already have a problem of kids not getting enough food, being fed tasteless food, and then you have to put in more sugar because sugar is one way to make food actually more tasty and more palatable. So the sodium regulations just aren't based in any science at all.
No, I totally agree. And John Black makes a good point. School lunches are just another underfunded program. True. Schools lose money and are backed into a corner on having to purchase cheap food. Also agree. And then John says that kids can take their own lunch to any school. How would you answer John on these two comments?
Well, I mean, I think that I know that there have been experiments that they have, you know, in various school systems where they have brought back in local chefs. One of the problems is outsourcing and to, you know, large national vendors, which is how those large multi-processed food companies want, is that they want everybody to be buying their food. But there have been experiments to return to local chefs or, you know, local having food made locally at the school and that it is affordable. I mean, it's just the direction we ought to be experimenting in and heading in as fast as possible. Mm-hmm. As kids bringing their own lunch, great if you can afford it. But a lot of kids can't, right? That's the key exactly. thing. A lot of kids are stuck. And probably those are the kids who are, you know, also have like other social determinants of health are poor and probably less able to exercise or would have less food at home that's healthy. So, you know, those are the kids who most need healthy food.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I'll tell you a story that happened here locally at a very small local school. There were a couple of the lunch ladies who had been working at the school for 20, 30 years, and they had seen the degradation of what was unloaded off the Sysco truck. That's the local distributor that distributes the school lunches and stuff. And so every now and then they would just not serve that to the kids. They would get in the kitchen and they would prepare a meat and three lunch, or they would make them real bacon and eggs for breakfast. And also they'd put some biscuits on there too, because in Tennessee you have to have a biscuit or you haven't had breakfast, right? And so a well-meaning parent reported them to the whoever you report to, the USDA, and they got a letter from the USDA saying that they would lose all of their federal funding, not just for school lunch, but all federal funding for the entire school if they were caught doing that again. And that I was like, wow. So feeding children real food versus fake food will get all of your federal funding poor. Yeah. And that was kind of my wake up moment. Yeah. That's like 20 years ago that happened. And I was like, wait, what world are we living in?
No, and that's not an isolated story. I'll tell you another one that happened in Philadelphia where these lunch ladies or whoever, they wanted to bring whole milk into schools. They wanted to just give it away for free or hand it out in the parking lot. And then they were told, also that school system was told that they would lose all of their, not just their school, but the whole state would lose its school lunch funding if they allowed any whole milk, you couldn't even give it away. And they couldn't even stand in the parking lot to give it out. They had to like go across the street to hand out whole milk to kids.
And, you know, there are more and more people in the United States who are more conspiracy minded lately, right? And I'm not one of those people. And I know you're not one of those people either. But in some respects, you can hardly blame the conspiracy minded people. It's like these women were trying to give away whole milk, which is that is literally the food that every mammal on the planet gives to its offspring into young growing members of its species, including human beings. And they were trying to give that away. And the fact that their feet were standing on school property almost made the entire school system lose their funding. And then people wonder why people start buying into conspiracy theories. It's like, right. At some point, right. You've got to start going, what the hell is going on here? What kind of world are we living in? So now let's transition now, Nina. Let's talk about, I'm sure everybody's seen the latest attack on the ketogenic diet. And I want you to take this and run with it and tell us what we need to know about this.
Yeah, I'm writing a column called Unsettled Science on a platform called Substack. And
yes,
since January, so the first 6 months of this year, I noticed, several waves of anti-keto headlines, mainly saying they cause heart disease, they might cause a heart attack, and dozens of them in news outlets like CNN and Forbes and Good Morning America. I mean, not small news outlets. And so I decided to really look into these, what was causing these episodes. The first one was, of course, the U.S. News and World Report, their annual diet issue, which always tanks keto. And I won't go all into that, but they basically have they're completely unhinged from the actual science. And if you look at four of their top ranking diets, they've never even been tested in a single clinical trial. I mean, they really just have no relationship to the science. But I think more concerning were the next two set of headlines. Okay, one came out of the American College of Cardiology, which I'm just going to call the ACC. And this is the second one that came out of the American Heart Association. So let's take the American Heart Association first, because that's the most recent one. There were all these headlines, like the one you just saw in the Washington Post, saying, keto diet concerns it causes heart attack. Well, if you look at this, the American Heart Association statement, it's a scientific statement that they published a couple weeks ago. They don't actually analyze the heart disease outcomes of any diet. They looked at a number of popular diets, and their criteria were, how close was that diet to the American Heart Association diet? How much were you like us? It was like a purity test. Stand up and say you're like the American Heart Association diet. And that was the only criteria that they used. And according to them, then the dietary DASH, what's known as DASH, it's a low sodium diet, that was the number one ranked popular diet because that is the American Heart Association's own diet. So, at the bottom of the list, predictably, were keto and paleo and low carb because they're unlike the American Heart Association diet. That was not in any way an examination of the actual evidence. What happened was, in the course of this paper, they took the opportunity to just throw in some non-systematic, just kind of random observations about negative effects that have been seen of low-carb diets. But, things that are just like old critiques of it. Oh, the keto flu, and you might experience nausea, and you'll see maybe a rise in LDL, discounting the fact that there are all these other improvements that you see, in the study, the largest study, reversing type 2 diabetes using a ketogenic diet, 23 out of 26 cardiovascular risk factors all improved at 1 year on the keto diet. And something called the ASCVD score, which is the American Heart Association's own cardiovascular risk score, decreased by 12% in this trial that was at 1 year. So really big improvements. Almost every marker is going in the right direction for heart disease and keto. That was all ignored.
Let's just reiterate, that was with a ketogenic diet, not with the DASH diets.
This is all a ketogenic diet I'm talking about. I'm sorry.
Yeah. The DASH diet, I looked into it a few years ago, and the research supporting the DASH diet, and most people don't realize this. They think, oh, no, if the AHA, if they recommend a diet, that must have been just scrutinized, and there must be reams and reams and decades of research. And basically all the DASH diet does, it's a super low sodium, super low saturated fat diet. And the outcome was that it lowers your systolic blood pressure four to five points, and it lowers your diastolic number by 1 to 2 points. It literally does virtually nothing. And so, if you know, the confidence interval there, I bet, was tiny. But it's going to basically, if you take a deep breath, you can lower your blood pressure more than eating the DASH diet. And based on that research alone, that has become the AHA recommended diet. And it never has been shown to reverse the markers of cardiovascular disease like the ketogenic diet has been shown to do.
Right. And the DASH diet was only studied on about 1,200 people in experiments lasting no more than 6 months. So yep. When you hear, oh, we have no long-term data on the ketogenic diet and we can't trust it. The DASH diet, which is the American Heart Association didn't just endorse it, it developed it. That diet has only been studied for 6 months or less and only in middle-aged hypertensive patients. So patients who already have hypertension and only in middle-aged people. So like they're, you know, to recommend this to a general population is just not warranted, right?
Right.
But anyway, that's the gold standard against which they're analyzing other diets. And again, they're not actually analyzing the cardiovascular outcomes. They're simply saying DASH is best. How close are you to DASH? And that's
yep.
it.
Yep.
So
Bill asked a prescient question. He says, where do the AHA get their funding? Hold on, Bill. We're going to get to that. Don't you worry.
This was not a scientific statement looking at diet and cardiovascular outcomes. But as I said, it did take this opportunity to lob some pot shots at the keto diet. And that resulted in, I don't think we're ready for that slide.
Okay.
That resulted in a lot of headlines, a lot of mainstream news outlets took that up. But so that is basically mis or disinformation, fake news, whatever. It's just not. There is no evidence there that keto is bad for heart health coming out of the American Heart Association. And to go to the funding question, there is a slide there. I don't know what order it is, but.
Yeah, we'll get to that one in a second. And let me just tell everybody, I added two slides at the end of Nina's slides that most people think, well, yeah, that's just being reported in Vegan News and, you know, She Finds and just little websites. There's not really anybody who's has any real traction is reporting this, but this was reported on CNN, Fox News, MSNBC, Time, Newsweek. All of the major outlets covered this, but I'm going to show you an outlet that most Americans don't have access to. They do not have a subscription to this periodical that only doctors read. And I want to show you how this filters down to a doctor's journal that I received recently. So, but we'll get to that in a second. Continue, right. Nina. Thank you.
Well, I was I was going to respond to the funding question. I know you have a slide on that maybe I'll show later, but
I'll see if I can find that and I'll pull it up.
When
the
I
one that's the ADA and AHA, is that the one?
Yeah. And
okay,
kind of a blue chart. So it's very hard to really get to numbers when it comes to the amount of funding. But when I looked into this for a paper that I did that was published in the BMJ, I could determine that the American College of Cardiology was getting, I believe it's 38% of their funding from industry. This is some years ago. And the American Heart Association was getting in the 20% range. And that's just the amount that was actually being disclosed, because you know that there's many, many ways of contributing funding to these organizations through conference sponsorship and other ways that it's very, very hard to get really good numbers on this. But they do have a lot of corporate financing, which has to influence these groups. One has to assume.
Well, absolutely. Just any person can, if I ask them, hey, what if I reached into your pocket and took away 20 to 30% of your income? If I were going to threaten you with that, would you maybe say something that I kind of wanted you to say? And I think the average person is like a 30% pay cut. Yeah. What do you want me to say? And so, you know, the American Heart Association tries to put themselves out there as this very ethical organization. But I looked into them a couple of years ago in the process of making a video about their funding. And I found what you found. It's very opaque, even though they are a public nonprofit. you would think that they would have to file a tax return with all this stuff on there, but you literally cannot find how much money they have been given from all sources. And as you intimated, from all angles, because there's many different ways that you can donate some money to an organization like the American Heart Association. But you just cannot find the data anywhere that I looked.
Yeah, I had the same experience. So you really, I think you would have to dig into some serious internet research or trying to get some whistleblower to help you out. But I think that we can, you can see from their conferences, what the sponsorships are, and it's pretty obvious that there's a lot of pharma money, at least in both of these groups, and food money in the American Heart Association. So, but do you want to talk about the American College of Cardiology? Because that was another whole spate of anti-keto headlines that I think...
Absolutely. Did you send me slides on that?
I think there's the one of the woman's Twitter account. I mean, that's part of it.
Let me pull that up.
Let me just sort of set this up, which is that a whole bunch of maybe 30 to 40 headlines came out. And again, in a lot of top media, saying a keto or keto-like diet was linked to higher risk of cardiovascular events. Like this is, you're going to have a heart attack, and it increases your LDL, your so-called bad cholesterol. And it turned out, when you kind of dug down, that came out of an ACC conference from this researcher, Yulia Yatin, who just presented her findings in a spoken way, right? She just spoke them. It was not in an abstract or in a preprint publication, which is typically how, researchers will put out there or get some record of their peer-reviewed work, is to publish it in some form or another. Nothing of the kind. It was just something, presentation she had given at a conference. And the ACC press released it. They actually put it out in a press release. There's just based on nothing. And I actually dug through the 40 or so press releases that were put out by the ACC during this conference. And only two of them were on unpublished information. So it was this woman Yatin's work and one other work. I couldn't find any, publication related to it. But I mean, everything else was a registered clinical trial or simultaneously published or published beforehand. So I asked the ACC, why did you publish why did you press release such weak data? I mean, it was non-existent. We don't even know if it's for real. It could just be made up. It's an observational study anyway, so we don't even know. That's the weakest kind of data quality to begin with. And they didn't give a very rational explanation. They said, well, we sometimes do that for clinical research findings that are unpublished, but this was not a clinical trial. So there really was not an explanation for why they not only press released it, but they promoted it and they retweeted every keto headline. And, they were really promoting this anti-keto message.
So let me get this straight, because I'm just a simple country boy, Nina. You're telling me that there was no new research. There wasn't a new study. Was this even a poster at the conference? No. Or she just got up and basically stated her opinion, and then magically that was put out in a press release. And then also magically, all of these news organizations started to publish basically photocopied articles saying keto will kill you. Is that what you're trying to tell us?
I think, unfortunately, that is actually what I'm saying. And this is by the American College of Cardiology, which is, the foremost group for cardiologists
in the world.
Yeah, and their guidelines are taken seriously and followed by cardiologists all across the United States. Their guidelines are followed in doctors' offices. So it's really, it's incredible, actually, to think that they are promoting this. This is, so what you're looking at now was actually a press release that was, or a post that was put out. This is this researcher, Yatin. This is her employer, or this is where she teaches. She also works in a clinic. And of course, I couldn't reach Yatin, right? Not available for any interviews. And her press representative reaches out to me and says, You know, she's not available. You can't talk to her. And by the way, if you use the word keto in your story, I will insist on a correction. So let me just unpack that for you because it's so wild. It turns out Eaton did not even, you know, whatever she did not look at the keto diet. Her macronutrients were way higher in carbs and lower in fat. So she didn't even look at the keto diet. And yet her employer and everybody's putting out posts on keto, but they're also trying to deny it and pretend like, well, it's all our fault for misunderstanding them about keto. I mean, it's so Orwellian. Like we can't even, in science, I know we're dealing with a lot in our society of words changing meaning or words losing meaning. But, you know, in science, a definition is super important. Like that's the starting point of science. If I'm studying, if I'm studying the keto diet, we have to know what we're talking about here. It can't mean like 10 carbs to me and 100 carbs to you. Otherwise, we're not doing science.
Right.
I mean, grams of carbs. So all of a sudden, you know, it's almost like they're trying to play games in this weird Orwellian way with the very language of nutrition. And just again, this is coming from the top. You know, there is so much messaging, as you said, like there's so many wild conspiracy theories out there now to which I don't subscribe, but there's so much concern about whom we can trust. And most of the time, there's a lot of warnings about the internet crazies and the people who are starting fads and the people that you can't trust on YouTube, like, you know, and all this craziness out there in the social media sphere. And yet right now we're talking about some of the top organizations, trusted public health organizations in the country that are putting out what is basically bad information.
And here back to your other graphic. So basically the big food companies feed us the high carbohydrate nutrient void food that leads to chronic disease. And then Big Pharma steps in on the other side and says, oh, we've got a pill for that. Whether it's type 2 diabetes, well, they don't have one for fatty liver yet, but I guarantee you they're looking. Hypertension, depression, any of the things that come from eating this highly processed, ultra processed, high carb, inflammatory, nutrient void food. So, but then when you look at the funding for not only the American Heart Association, but also the American Diabetes Association on the right, it's all of these companies. The first group of companies, food, who are causing the problem. And then you've got all the healthcare and the big pharmaceutical concerns who are managing the symptoms because they're not reversing any disease. And then you've got all the pharmacies, basically, and the grocery stores that are selling either the cause or selling the pseudo solution. That's who's funding the American Heart Association and the American Diabetes Association, somewhere between 20 and 50% of their total annual income. And yet we're not supposed to take, there's not supposed to be a take-home message from that, Nina?
Well, what I think is they've achieved perfect vertical integration, right? For sick care. They've figured out how to vertically integrate the ability to make you sick, get you sick, and then treat or manage that sickness. And that's all a very profitable, every person out there is a very profitable model if you're sick. I mean, chronic disease is one of the fastest growing industries in America. We understand like there's a profit motive that just can't be denied here. And they're making money off of people being sick.
So the two least profitable classes of people would be people who are eating real food and don't suffer from chronic diseases or people who have died. Those are the two people they can't really they don't want to just make a one-time sale. They want a repetitive sale. You go to the grocery store once a week and buy the crap, or the school cafeteria. They put in an order every month for the crap, or you have to go to the pharmacy once a month or every 3 months for your refills. That's what they want is a revenue stream that's ongoing. So the only people that big food and big pharma don't profit from are people who are smart like you and I and eat a proper human diet. And we don't eat that stuff. And we also don't need a handful of pills every day because we ate that stuff. So everybody out there, if you suffer from multiple chronic diseases, you should maybe look at the people who fund the American Heart Association and the American Diabetes Association and say, oh yeah, I buy their products all the time on the left for food. And oh yeah, in the middle, I buy their drugs all the time. And then on the right, yeah, I'm at that grocery store or that pharmacy all the time. You are literally a repetitive cash cow for these billion-dollar corporations. And it is in your hands to take back, keep your money and to take back your power. But if you're giving all your money to them, you don't have any power.
Well said, Dr. Kenberry. Absolutely. You should be going, you should be going to the pharmacy to get toothpaste. And that's it.
Exactly. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, let me show you something, Nina, that I once a month I get this in. It's called Family Practice News. And let me pull this up here. So Family Practice News, it's just a little throwaway, kind of a news article thing that every family physician in the country gets a copy of this for free. Now, for free, you say, how could you put out a 30-page thing once a month for free? Well, if you look on the back right here, here's a big full-page ad, right, for a medical company. And all through here, they're drug ads. That's how it's free. So now let me show you one of the articles. So that's the cover, Family Practice News. And I think it is available online, but you're never going to get a copy of that in your mailbox unless you're a family physician. Now, on page 3 or 4, keto diet linked to doubling of heart disease risk.
Wow.
And it's under the cardiology section, right? Now, a lot of people think doctors are special. They're a rare genius breed. No, doctors are just dudes and chicks, just like you. That's exactly what they are. They are just as susceptible of being busy and just reading this headline and not taking the time to read this entire article. Or if they do peruse the article, they're not going to read it critically. They're just basically they're reading this for entertainment. But do you not think that gets into the subconscious mind, the unconscious mind? And if they have a preconceived notion about a plant-based diet, this is going to reinforce that. But when you read this article very carefully, I actually shared this inside the private group that we're live in front of now. And I said, read this critically, read it very carefully. And I want you to see how many errors, logical errors and factual errors you can find in this. And you should have seen the comments, Nina. They literally tore this to shreds. So basically, when you read this critically and boil it down, basically it says, if you eat a ketogenic diet, it might raise your LDL. That's literally the only finding, and that's a potential finding. There's no new research about the doubling of heart disease risk. The only finding was, it might raise your LDL. That's literally it. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, and I think this is because of the keto-like. I think that's what came out of this Yatin's research, which, again, was just spoken. We have no idea what the data set was, what it looked like, what the numbers were, what she actually found. If it's like nothing. It hasn't been through peer review. It hasn't been on a poster board. That's non-news.
Right.
At this point, you have to realize what we're getting is something more like a propaganda campaign based on zero facts from the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association. Related to science. Like, you can't, there's no relationship to actual scientific endeavors.
And everybody should be asking themselves, Nina, why would an organization like the ACC or the AHA, their reputation is, that's literally everything to that organization. If they lose their reputation, they're finished. They're done. They're over. Nobody's going to listen to them. Why would an organization whose reputation is everything to them, why would they promulgate something like this? How would this trickle down to all the medical journals, all the mainstream media, knowing that there are reams of data, scores of research studies showing that a ketogenic diet actually reverses the risk factors for CVD, coronary vascular disease. It reverses those. This is in the scientific literature. And there's nothing to show that the DASH diet does that. There's nothing to show that a plant-based diet does that to the degree that a ketogenic diet does. Why is the money that important to them that they're not worried about the research, their reputation at all? Or are they just so sure of themselves and so unworried about keto that they're not even trying, because this makes it look like they're worried about keto, doesn't it?
Yeah. Ken, I think it's a really interesting question, and I obviously can't get inside their heads. And there, as we've seen, there's a financial motive, but I think they might be thinking the following, which is, we bet a long time back on the low fat diet, right? And we have to double down on that because precisely what you said, because they're afraid of losing their reputation. If they're known to have been recommending an ineffective diet that very likely worsens heart disease, right? From the data that you and I could discuss at some point, but you know, for 60 years, in the case of the American Heart Association, that looks really, really bad. So I think their calculus might be, we cannot give up on the diet that we've been recommending for 60 years. So let us annihilate, or try to annihilate, the competition. And that's why they are not just standing idly by while keto is spreading across America and people are taking it up along with carnivore. They have to actually actively try to quash it, which is why I wrote this article, to try to get to the bottom of it, because to me it does not look like genuine concern based on any real science. It looks to me like ginned up non-factual information that is really just packaged in a media campaign to try to denigrate, or to create tremendous doubt in people's mind about keto.
Yeah, it's really, truly unbelievable. And I have so much respect for you for fighting this battle at the top, because as you know, I'm fighting at the bottom. I'm going to just the regular man and woman in the street and saying, hey, give me the donut. That's really bad for you. Let me tell you what you should eat instead. But you've taken it upon yourself to try to change the AHA, the ADA, the USDA. And I mean, man, some people might call you a Quixote, but I don't know. I feel like that if we fight from the bottom and the top together, hand in hand, Nina, I think that we might get a little traction.
Well, it takes a village, right, Ken? It's like, listen, you have to, we don't have time to go into it now. We have accomplished a lot in terms of battling the guidelines, but it is like, it is an epic battle and it's going to take a while. And so I'm also trying to like give people information that they need to battle on their own, right? Like somebody says, you know, the keto diet is bad for your cardiologist, is warning you off your keto diet. Take my article and say, look, this is what, you know, this is what this is actually about. Just read it. So you need to come at it from all angles. Like you and I have talked about this before, but like we need the bottom up revolution, and we need to be battling at the level of thought influencers and ideas and in the realm of public health. I mean, like it has to happen, that policy has to change. And just as a final thought, like why does policy have to change? Because it has such a stranglehold on our food economy, right? Like how you started off, it's in our schools, it's in our hospitals, it's in our, like, you can't avoid it. And so we have to change it because it is a top-down system in many ways.
Absolutely. And this is a Thursday that we filmed this on. Every single child in the United States today, the school lunch that they were fed consisted of basically cookies and potato chips from PepsiCo, Coca-Cola, Mondelez, Kraft Heinz, and others. That's what they were fed today. And that's also what they'll be fed tomorrow. And then next Monday, they'll be fed that again. And then we'll wonder where this epidemic of pediatric obesity, pediatric type 2 diabetes, pediatric fatty liver, where is that coming from? Why do all the kids have ADHD now? What's happening to our children? It's like they're genetically falling apart or something. I would opine perhaps they're not falling apart genetically. Perhaps it's the shitty diet that they're being fed at least 5 days a week at your local school. Would there be any traction for a parent going to their local school board? How would that fly, Nina? Would that do anything at all?
I don't have an easy answer to that. I know that parents have organized to change their school lunches, and they have, in some cases, been successful. Unfortunately, in New York, they organized and got vegan Fridays. So, you know, that's like an unhappy example to share, where we already had meatless Mondays. So, I mean, uh, but Yeah, I think it is possible. And I think, you know, one of the arguments you take to them is like, this is a nutritionally insufficient diet. Like, you aren't even meeting the basic requirements needed for basic human health. I mean, there's some pretty strong arguments against having a high grain, high sugar diet. Like, I think you could really make a case that these diets are actively harming our children.
100% agree. Absolutely. And my followers know I'm never going to stop fighting. And let me reassure you guys, Nina's never going to stop fighting. I've met this lady. We've chatted. She is as dogged. She is never going to let go of this bone. I can promise you that. She is going to fight this fight to the bitter end until keto ultimately is recognized as the proper human diet that it is. That's what's going to happen. Nina, thank you so very much for taking the time to chat with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Ken. Great to be in this fight with you.
Absolutely. I can't wait till we can meet up again and plan strategy. See you next time.
All right. Thank you.